Sin doesn't ruin human lives and all the creation by itself. Sin also brings the consequence of suffering. Hebrews 2:18 promises, "For because Jesus himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." Today we are joined by a special guest who explores real suffering, memory, and healing in the worlds of fiction and in reality, novelist J.J. Fisher.
Speculative fiction, like no other genre, reflects the creativity of God.
If you look at the scriptures, you're going to have to see that God uses imagination more than rational discourse.
We are supposed to be image bearers for a vastly creative God.
Reading fantastical fiction opened a portal in my imagination for a place other than just a materialistic world.
I experienced the gospel story with the mind of someone who loved adventure and loved the idea of light conquering darkness.
We're wired for stories that reflect how we see the world in ways that are true.
The story is either pointing to Christ or it's pointing to our need for Christ.
Welcome back to Fantastical Truth, the podcast from lorehaven.com, entering Holy Week 2024. This podcast explores fantastical stories for God's glory. And I'm E. Stephen Burnett, the publisher of Lorehaven and co-author of The Pop Culture Parent.
And I'm Zachary Russell. And right now I am suffering from Central Texas allergies. We've had cedar, oak, now we're getting ragweed and mold and all kinds of things. Everything is growing and green and fuzzy, and it's just killing me. So this episode is really relevant. This is episode 205, How Will Jesus Save Us from Suffering and Death? And we're going to be joined in just a moment by author J.J. Fisher.
Adam and Eve did not have antihistamines when they were going out there trying to grow things from the earth and stepping on thorns and thistles and having weeds interfere with the fruits and vegetables. We often don't think about all those pollens that they were also getting into their lungs and sinuses. And Zach, I am with you. Hopefully you can't hear it in my voice, but Central Texas has no state income tax, but what it does have is a tax on the immune system. And mine has gone nuts, not just because of the cold, but because of all those ridiculous thorns and thistles in my head. And thorns and thistles are going to be the theme of this episode and what they represent throughout scripture. But most importantly, how Jesus, our great physician, has come to heal us from these sufferings and worse.
Yeah, you know, Stephen, I made a joke recently with a friend that the thorn in my flesh is the birthday parties of other kids that I have to go to sometimes, because who really wants to go to the... Now, obviously, I love my kids' birthday parties, and everyone loves their kids' birthday parties, but other birthday parties, I just can't eat a lot of sugar, so I see beautiful cakes, and I'm like, well, that's great, but I can't have that because I suffer from a very high intolerance to sugar and gluten and other things. So, man, I cannot wait for the new heavens and new earth when I get a new body that has no allergies, no diabetes, and I can just feast at the Lamb's Supper on all kinds of things without worrying.
Speaking of eating better and thinking better, recovering from suffering, and also being aware of how stories shape our brains, our next guest just had a new article published at lorehaven.com. That is the parent site over fantastical truth. That article was How Stories Physically Reshape Our Brains for Good or Ill. And the pitch for that by Jasmine Fisher is, since the escapism calls from J.R.R. Tolkien and Ursula K. Le Guin, fictional fantasy has taken a turn towards shallow and sensual themes that can hurt us. Yes, according to the science, and it may actually be real, the science there, fiction helps rewire your brain, sometimes in great ways, but sometimes in not so great ways. And to explore why this is both a threat to you and something you want to discern and be aware of, go check out that article. You can subscribe free at lorehaven.com and get updates whenever we post new articles, new podcast episodes like this one, new reviews. You can also join the Lorehaven Guild, our exclusive Discord server, in which we undertake fantastical book quests into the best Christian-made stories that we can find. Just subscribe free now at lorehaven.com. We'll email you the exclusive access code there. Our top sponsor for today is Oasis Family Media, once again loaning their spot to the 1232 Adventure Podcast. Sometimes it takes getting out of your comfort zone for God to speak to you. In the case of twins Rona and Flint Thatcher, it takes going back in time for God to get a word in edgewise. When the experimental research of a physicist goes awry, his estranged twin children follow him to medieval Wales, where a shattered kingdom forces them to confront their broken relationship. Yes, indeed, Oasis Audio would like to introduce you to this epic and riveting audio drama, 1232, a time travel medieval fantasy adventure for all ages. It's written by Callie Sue and Cheyenne Bell, produced by Rumble Stump Entertainment, with new episodes out every Wednesday. Travel with Rona and Flint to medieval Wales in the year 1232 AD, where they come face to face with a brutal world filled with superstition and legends. Will they find the strength to survive a past that has been tainted by the future? New episodes of 1232 are out every Wednesday on all streaming platforms where podcasts and audiobooks are available. To find where to listen, visit audio-epic.com. That is audio-epic.com. See the link in our show notes for episode 205 or go to lorehaven.com/podcast. Someone is stepping through the painting, a painting of a world that we look forward to entering, but instead she's popping through into our side of the painting. Let's welcome her to the studio. Jasmine Fisher, or JJ Fisher, lives with her husband on the beautiful central coast of New South Wales, Australia, where she enjoys reading, going for long walks, and forgetting to water her plants. Originally a psychologist with a master's degree in clinical psychology, Jasmine works as a Christian fantasy author and freelance editor. Last year, her novel, Calore, won the 2023 Realm Award Book of the Year. Follow her literary adventures at jjfisher.com, subscribe to her newsletter, follow her on socials, but due to the rising cost of bird seed, she no longer accepts carrier pigeons. But we can talk face-to-face, Jasmine. So great to see you. Glad you made it through.
Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to be here.
Yeah, this is so fun that you're our first Aussie on the podcast. So it's really cool to get to connect with you, 14 time zones away or whatever it is right now.
This is the first of a few pronunciation questions I have. Is it Aussie or Aussie? Is it a Z sound or an S sound? Which is it?
Aussie.
Aussie, as in Aussie and Harriet or Aussie Osborne. Okay.
Yes, that's the one.
First time I've ever name checked that guy on this podcast and probably the last, which is one of our concessions, I suppose. But we got some more relevant ones coming up here. It is Holy Week, at least for most Christian denominations, and I think that is the same no matter what hemisphere you are in. And this episode is part three of our He Saves Us series on the podcast. And therefore, we have a specific topical focus here, as always. So if anybody out there, I see you Calvinists lurking out there, you guys aren't talking about penal substitutionary atonement. We did. Promise, we did. It was in part two. In part two, we explored how Jesus does substitute himself to suffer the wrath of God and save us from the final boss at the cross, which is human villainy, our sin. We are dead in transgressions and sins, all acknowledged, all up front. And in part one, a couple of weeks ago, we already explored also a little Christus Victor, how Jesus has also defeated the devil. He did that in the past, and now he's saving us from our sin now. But in this episode, we're talking about the consequences of sin, punishment, a curse, things that God sent into the world as a response to sin. That is like our fault in Adam, but not always our fault. In fact, usually not our fault. You know, it's not your fault if you get cancer. It's not your fault if you have some sort of mental struggle that has nothing to do with your choices. And it's not our specific fault that we die, but it is our fault collectively as human beings that the sin got here. So that's what we're going to explore today, how these images, these thorns and thistles and sufferings recur throughout fiction, including Jasmine Fisher stories, but also show up in reality. So we'll talk a little bit of what you might call trauma here, but it is a means to an end. We're not going to circle the subject of trauma all the time. We understand that this is a temporary affliction that people have. And it does eventually, unfortunately, it does lead to the last enemy, death. But 1 Corinthians 15:26 promises us that in the end, although Jesus has already defeated sin, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. So I suppose, actually, Zach, death is the final boss, not at the cross, but in the future. Any other tasty concessions that y'all may have brought, either from the house next door or from all the way in Australia?
Well, like a good Baptist, I think about everything in terms of three points that all alliterate. So Jesus saves us from the penalty of sin, and he has saved us from that. He is saving us from the power of sin, and he will save us from the presence of sin. And along with sin comes suffering and death and everything else. But, you know, we're in that sort of middle period where sin still happens, death still happens, suffering still happens, but he is saving us from those things in different ways, sometimes not completely saved from those things, and we'll get into that. But we have been saved in the past by the penalty of sin. That was our previous
episode. From the penalty, right.
Yeah. And, you know, in the future, when he returns, the presence of sin, suffering, and death will be no more. It's so easy to talk about either of those things, right? The past or the future. It's so hard, I think, to talk about what does that mean now? You know, we talk about where is the sting of death? Well, we still die. There is still a sting, but not what it was. It's this middle period that is so hard to make sense of, I think, sometimes.
Jasmine, I think now that Zach has made his alliterative points, I want to talk about your degree in clinical psychology, where the P is silent. Got to say, though, the last time I read a fantastical novel by a Christian psychologist, it was one I don't even know whether to talk about right now. It was an end times thriller from the early 1990s. I'll name it. It's called The Third Millennium, and it's one of the worst books I've ever written. Because and the sequels are even worse. I kept reading the series millennium? Out of morbid. No, it was the third millennium. There was the third, then there was
the
fourth.
The sequel, the fourth?
The fourth was the sequel. But there was the Beyond the Millennium, where I remember where the author just stopped the story cold to take us into the psychologist's office and start sharing jargon with us about getting in touch with our inner child or something. I just want to stress, you, Jasmine, like, it's very clear from reading Calore, which I've done, like, you do not do that. And yet when I read that you were a clinical psychologist originally, I thought, yeah, that tracks, because that book had a way of getting into my brain.
That's lovely to hear. Yeah, no, it's something which has definitely shaped my stories. But like with all of my books, I hope that preachy, or I'm not there for it to be therapeutic in a sense that you're sitting across and a psychologist is unpacking your brain and how do you feel about this? How do you feel about this? Let's dive into that, you know, past trauma or this thing. But it's approaching, I guess, general questions of how we deal with pain, the role of memory. If, you know, and the premise of Calore is in a world where you could delete that pain rarely, or you could take on certain memories, things like that, how would that sort of effect be? So yes, my practicing really did affect, but yes, hopefully it doesn't come across as preachy in that sense.
Oh, it did not. And trust me, I would have complained if it had. Now, I believe that we ought to have, as Christians, we ought to have sermons, but the place of the sermon is in the church. And yet a bad sermon will sound preachy, whereas a good sermon will sound, well, yeah, preachy, obviously, but in the right way, because yeah. I just want to keep everything in its proper place. If I go to a novel to explore characters where there's flesh and decisions and worlds and all of this that help to illustrate eternal realities and truths and beauties, I don't expect a sermon there. But when I go to church for a sermon, I don't expect a novel. Just keep them separate. It's perfectly fine otherwise. Well, let's move to chapter one here. Just a bit of a setup with the biblical truth behind what we're talking about, the thorns and thistles and suffering and the decay of creation, and unfortunately, sometimes our own minds. Chapter one, I've titled, Human Sin Brought Consequences to Creation. And for that, we go back to the classic favorite around here, Genesis, the first three chapters that explain so much of our own world, God, the ultimate world builder there. In Genesis 1 through 2, we read how God created humans not just to sit around and be naked in a garden somewhere, but with a purpose. And their purpose was to be stewards over creation. Many theologians call this the cultural mandate. And by the way, that's essential learning if you want to figure out why we have stories and culture in the first place. The whole idea was Adam and Eve were supposed to be little regents representing God, reigning over the creation on his behalf for his glory. They weren't just sitting around praying or going to church in the ferns or something. No, they were supposed to go out, organize things, make stuff using God's stuff. That was their job. And originally, they would have lived forever without disease, without death or suffering. And for those of you who are here to think about mental health a bit, imagine then back in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve with perfect mental health, no trauma, no tragedies, nothing in a world without sin, nothing but clarity of focus and different levels of happiness, just happiness all the time, and the satisfaction of knowing what they were put there to do and being in relationship with one another, with the creation, which is distinct from them, and with God as well. Unfortunately, it all goes downhill in Genesis 3, in which humans chose to rebel against God's good created order. And there's all kinds of stuff in there about personal sin and guilt and the things we went over in our last episode. But here I'm going to emphasize the consequence that God promises, not a good kind of promise either. God starts cursing things. He curses the serpent, he curses Eve, and he curses Adam, and he curses the ground. Cursed is the ground because of human beings' sin. Now Adam's and Eve's quest to steward the earth is subjected to futility. That's a phrase from Romans 8. And instead of it being easy to plant stuff and grow stuff, you get thorns and thistles. You get literal thorns and thistles. But I think also that can be seen as an image that pictures the disorder and tragedy of creation. You're supposed to get fruits and vegetables out of the earth, and it's supposed to be simple and fun and joyous. But now the earth strikes back. Now you've got trauma. Now you've got issues with the creation, to put it mildly. And that, I would say, is why we have so many of these images in our fiction as well. The best kinds of novels, like I will stump for Kalor here. I still need to read Lumen, by the way, Jasmine. But Kalor shows that reality of an earth, of a culture that has been afflicted by some great tragedy in the past. It's almost a kind of a post-dystopian setting there, but maybe that's why I got absorbed so much into that world, because it's dark, it's cold, like it's a little grim dark, but with so much hope just around the corner, just enough to keep me going, and yet not a token hope. Like it actually feels that there is a happiness to be achieved in the future. But until then, we've got to slog through the ice a little bit. I'm curious what images and ideas led you, Jasmine, to put together a award-winning novel like Kalor, book one of the Nightingale trilogy.
Yeah, I love that you described it as a little bit grimdark with little bits of hope, because that's really my intent for all my work, is you know, that there's moments of great darkness and it's gritty and realistic and true to life. I think it's an attempt to capture that, yeah, the wrongness of the world, that when we look at it, we know that something's not right. We know that things aren't as God intended them to be. And we can see the brokenness, we can see the awful wrongness of the world. And I was also, drawing on my experiences of being a psychologist and seeing people's pain. There was a lot of trauma there. I experienced trauma of my own when I was practicing. And I felt that as a helper trying to come in and trying to, redeem people's brokenness in, you know, sort of in a narrative sense, trying to bring healing and, you know, help them to find healing in their lives ultimately. There was often so many limitations to that, and I was limited by my own brokenness and my own sinfulness. And so, you know, there was a recognition there, I guess, that attempt to sort of help people and to help them process was also taking its toll. So you can see that in Stephanie's character, that she's, you know, what's called a mem. She has this ability to rearrange memories and to extract memories, you know, in physical, tangible form. But there's a cost to that. You know, she herself can't remember her own past, belonging to sort of have this family, to have this belonging. I hate that word because of associations with Year 12 English. She's sort of longing to have her place in the world and to have healing in terms of her own story. But that she can also see that the attempts that she makes to help everyone around, often not helping, often compounding the problem, and there's a temporariness. So she's sort of coming up against time and time again the limitations of, I guess, humans to help other humans. And so that was very much shaped by my experiences in clinical psychology and, I guess, the things that I was trying to do and, you know, honourable attentions. But incredible limitations sometimes when looking at just the enormity of the pain that humans experience.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating concept of a character with the ability to rearrange or delete memories in order to take away pain. And, you know, I think about movies immediately, like Total Recall or Inception, you know, just this ways that people try to mess with the mind. It doesn't always go so well. But then also thinking about how with Jesus, when he was resurrected, his body was put back together, but he still had scars. And I've always found that so interesting. Like, why didn't he just totally remove that evidence that he was killed? Like, why leave the scar? I mean, obviously, his body was alive again, so it seems like a minor detail, but there had to be some intentionality behind it. And I imagine he wasn't in pain, but it's like there is a reminder of what happened. And I guess, you know, I don't know why God chose to do that way, but what I think is if he had totally removed it, then maybe it would have made it hard for the disciples to believe that he had actually died, or that he wasn't just a clone or something. You know, earlier I was talking to some people about the Christ clone trilogy, this end times novel, and it's about an evil clone of Jesus. And, you know, maybe that's what people would worry about. Like, is this a doppelganger? Is this a ghost that we're seeing? And he's like, this is actually me, because you remember how I got crucified. You can feel it for yourself. And there's something about scars and wounds that it's very mysterious to me that God doesn't totally remove those things. Even, you know, even our own memories of things that, like, he's forgiven us about, even our own sins, you know, why doesn't he just wipe away? He takes away the penalty of sin. Why doesn't he take away the memory of sin? You know, he lets us keep those, and there must be a purpose to that. And so, I think that I love how you're playing with that in the story to see what would happen if people were to use that power.
I love that. And it's so true. Yeah, we are left with those scars and with that memory of, you know, our sin and the things that, you know, we have done. It's amazing that God promises to remove that from us, you know, as far as the east from the west. That's an incredible promise. But it's kind of the healing that we have. It's the kind of the now but the not yet sort of thing. You know, there's an element of temporariness to the healing of this world.
Yeah, I think a lot of Christians, and I'm sure you've run into this too, Jasmine, particularly where your career has interfaced with your faith, and I might talk about this a little bit more later, but I think a lot of Christians have struggled, just people have struggled, to try to figure out, okay, what is a consequence of sin, and what is a consequence of just living in a groaning creation? And I think that going back to the scripture and getting that doctrine out, where we've just kind of put it on a shelf and forgotten that it exists, really helps us to understand the foundation of the better kinds of understanding about mental health and neuroscience and all of those things. Because although we are made in God's image, and therefore there's something special about human beings in particular, we are also bound to creation. We are material creatures. We are made up of chemicals and cells and all of those things. And sometimes at the material level, those things go wrong, not necessarily because we sinned, but because we are living in a world that has been afflicted by the curse. Creation is striking us back, not just with weeds and thorns and thistles and storms and earthquakes and such, but creation is striking back in our own bodies. I think that may be a nuance of what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 8, where he compares the creation itself, which is groaning with eager longing to be set free from this bondage to decay. Just an absolutely wonderful turn of phrase there. And Paul says that so we ourselves also groan inwardly. Creation is distinct from human beings. We are not pantheists. We don't believe that creation and humans, you know, it's all connected, brother. You know, we don't go for that sort of thing. But we are part of the creation because we are its stewards. You know, we are material creatures. And so creation's groaning, we're groaning. It's this chorus of groans out there and in here. Sin is corrupted, not just the world, but the consequence of humanity's collective sin has corrupted our memories, our experiences, and then even right down to the neurochemistry and our thought patterns and all of that. And that's why I really liked your article, Jasmine, because it got into that specifically in regards to fiction, like those external characteristics and how we choose them. can literally reshape our brains. And in the worst case scenarios, that can be part of what leads to mental health struggles or even disorders, you know, obsessions. And what are some of the things, not to, you know, get into your records or anything like that, but what are some of the things that you've seen, like trends that you've seen that are legitimate, you know, not just some fake disorder you hear about on a social media, but some real traumas, real anxieties and struggles that people are having out there as a result of God's curse and creation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I've experienced personally and professionally is real struggles with anxiety. I think that's become a bit of an epidemic, especially in certain generations, some of the younger generations that are growing up. That sense of we know that there's something wrong with the world. We know that there's an unsettledness there, but it's kind of like a broader sort of, I mean, in psychology, we call it generalized anxiety, that sense of anxiety about lots and lots of different things. But yeah, that's something that I've experienced too in terms of my own personal journey, is like that sense of, you know, I'm cognitively, you know, I know the strategies and that sort of thing, but you know, there is still sometimes just the anxiety that you wake up with in the morning, and that just makes it so it makes you so acutely aware that things are not yet right, that, you know, that things have not been restored in terms of the creation. And yeah, I know many times I've sort of had that groaning sort of, I can really resonate with that groaning, you know, the sense of, oh, when, Lord, you know, when is this going to be an end? So yeah, so definitely professionally I saw that a lot of struggles, obviously with depression, huge trauma. You know, we have, as the world, lived through a pandemic now, you know, in terms of economic uncertainty and all those sorts of things, you know, wars and rumors of wars, like this, there's so many different things in the background that are happening. And I think a lot of people are growing up with that sense of, oh, things are not settled, and we're rearranging lots of different things, even things that we would have once upon a time thought they're the certainties, you know, things like gender and that sort of thing. We're questioning everything. And I think that really leads to a climate of instability for people, and especially for young people, and an unsettledness that you can just see how much people are struggling with their conceptualizations of their own worth and their value to God. A little while ago, I gave a talk to our church youth group, and you know, it was just sort of talking about this is how God values you, and this is all the stuff that He did to bring you into the world and to create you, and He knit you together in your mother's womb and all those sorts of things. And you could just tell how much they were soaking that in, that message of you are a unique creation, and you know, this is the plan that God has to your life and all that sort of thing. It's just incredible how, yeah, self-esteem has really been rocked, I think, by some of those different cultural influences.
One of the consequences of God's curse on creation was also mutations, which leads me to our second sponsor today, author Liam Corley, with his debut science fiction novel, Changelings Insurgents, published by Millspeak Books, in which Commander Tauron didn't travel from the 26th century to kidnap a forgotten healer, but he will if that's what it takes to save his mutant son. Lots of mutations, lots of curses, and lots of healing in this episode. To end the war between humans and their mutant offspring, Tauron recruits a criminal, a scientist, and a scholar to search for genes that will purge the mutation. But trusting each other turns out to be the real fight. That is the pitch for Changelings Insurgents from author Liam Corley, which is available now wherever fine books are sold. And you can get all those purchase links in our show notes for episode 205, or go to lorehaven.com/podcast. Jasmine already mentioned this, which gives me some reassurance as we go into chapter 2, titled Human Doctors Can Relieve or Even Cure Some Ills, which props to them, props to scientists, props to humankind for muddling through and coming up with some processes and research and medications and all of these things, but with limitations. You wouldn't know that Jesus is a great physician if you didn't see some human physicians giving it their best, despite being bound by the same curse that has afflicted all of creation. rejoice, though, that although a lot of physicians, like even going back to Luke, who was such a decent physician that they even let him write one of the four Gospels, they had some limited success in coming up with herbs and processes and all of that. But you know, there's a lot of mythology tied in there. But one may think of the humors and bloodletting and all those things where they were getting some things right, but then they were getting a lot of things wrong, like hilariously, drastically wrong. And as for mental health, let's not even talk about the understandings before. I mean, it's not great now, but it's a little bit better. And then thanks to some growth in the understanding of the scientific theory and all of this, we get an explosion of wins for the medical profession, along with a whole lot of continued failures. And enough said about that. But it is, though, to the credit of God's common grace in the world, that we see doctors and others being able to relieve a lot of the illnesses that people suffer, or even prevent some of them with good vaccinations, or even cure some of them. Although notably, the common cold that I've underwent the past couple of weeks has not been cured. That just has to work its way out through the body. Maybe they cure it in the Star Trek future, but actually, come to think of it, I don't even think that the Federation has cured the common cold, so maybe one of those jokes there. But we see a lot of progress, and yet I think it's only recently, Jasmine, and you know, 60 seconds go to explain the growth of the mental health and psychological profession in the last few decades or so. But you certainly hear a lot more about mental health and wellness lately. There's professionals who are doing this. There are populist platforms that are doing this. Like, I want to focus on the good stuff here, and not the quacks, and not people, you know, talking in, you know, therapeutic jargon on TikTok or something. But we're hearing a lot more about this. And so a lot of therapy language, I think emphasizing here the good side of that, is helping to inform more stories. I don't mean like you pick up a fantasy novel and they're talking suddenly about anxiety by word, but the concepts are there, the ideas are there, it rhymes. And so when I'm reading Kalor, and presumably in your other books as well, the, what's it called here, the Soul Mark duology? Yes. Carver of Souls just came out, by the way, just this month. And then the Soul Mark book one of that duology came out, when was that here? Yeah, back here in May last year. Yeah, so you have been hard at work. I'm guessing that you've switched from your psychological career to writing now or publishing four novels in the space of a year or so. But all that to say, like, what are your thoughts on some of this growth of awareness of mental health? You know, maybe focusing on the pros here before we focus on the con.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely been more awareness. And I think people have more of a language for emotions and for understanding themselves. There's more talk. I think that it's really sort of normalized and validated. And I think that's a tremendous gain in itself, that we are talking about things like trauma. Mind you, that has, that's crossing over into cons, but, you know, that has become a little bit of a word for everything, you know, catch all for just the stuff wasn't going too well for me today, you know, all the way up to the big stuff kind of thing. But yeah, I think it is good that we're having a bit more of a language and that there is decreasing stigma, particularly around mental health. I was noticing when I was practicing, and yes, I am not practicing at the moment. I've been working very much full time between editing and writing. But yeah, there are a lot more people coming forward and acknowledging I need help with these things. I need to talk about it with somebody, and it's not enough just to talk about it with family or friends or that sort of thing. So that is, yeah, that is very much a good thing.
Yeah. You know, something that I've been reading a little bit about is the rise in telehealth appointments for mental health appointments. You know, obviously with the 2020 pandemic, the rise of video conferencing kind of took everything over, right? We went to work that way. We went to school that way. And we went to the therapist that way. From a lot of articles I'm reading, I mean, you're the expert here, but from a lot of things I've been reading, it seems like it's not as effective as people had hoped it would be to meet virtually, or it would make people feel satisfied, but like their ceiling for satisfaction was much lower. I don't quite know how to express what I've read about this, but it didn't quite meet people's needs. And the problem was a lot of people don't realize it's not meeting their needs. And it seems so interesting that it's still the same thing. It's still just a conversation with someone in real time. You would think it wouldn't matter if it's over Zoom or in a in an office where you share the same, you know, physical space. But I've been really curious to learn more about that. Does that ring a bell to you? Have you read anything along those lines?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's great, definitely, that those technologies are making it easier to see mental health professionals. And in here in Australia, we have really struggled from a lack of mental health professionals and people having to drive several hours to see somebody. Here on the Central Coast where I live, it's, you know, 6 months to a year sort of wait list to see someone, which is horrendous, absolutely awful, you know, especially if you're in an acute crisis. But yeah, I think the downsides of that, and obviously there are limitations to every therapy, and every, even our gold standard therapy still might only help, you know, 60 or 70% of people at most. But I think what we're starting to really miss, especially post pandemic, is that human connection. Like, studies are showing we have fewer friends, we have fewer social contacts than we ever have. Very few sort of close friends that we can share life with. And I think, yeah, there is that craving for, like, clients will always do better face to face than telehealth. I've done a fair bit of telehealth in my practicing. And yeah, it's just, there's something about that human connection and being in a physical presence. You can hide stuff on a Zoom screen. You can sort of make yourself as presentable as you possibly can. You know, you can sort of put your best foot forward. But you know, when you are in a therapist's, you know, sort of office, it's very hard to hide.
It could be as simple as that when you're on Zoom, first of all, you're not really making eye contact with the person, right? You're looking at their picture, they're looking at your picture, and probably for half the time you're looking at your own picture, like, oh, do I look okay? Do I look presentable? You know, does my room look okay? And so it's this weird pseudo conversation because you're not seeing them actually seeing you. You're seeing pixels of their eye. And it's like their eyes are kind of going off axis. And so it's sort of like if you've ever had a conversation with someone who, for one reason or another, has trouble with eye contact, it can be a little unnerving in a conversation to talk to someone who's not looking at you. You know, it might be for some challenges that person has, or they might just be really rude. They just don't want to pay you the honor of giving you eye contact. But another thing that's I learned about recently, this was on a podcast I listened to, someone created an AI chatbot based on all of the writings and podcasts and videos and textbooks of this very popular psychologist, because he's like, oh, I really want to meet this woman, but I'd never be able to get an appointment with her. So I'll just make my own little large LLM, large language model AI, and I'll just chat back and forth with that. It'll be just as good is seeing her in person. And like, he just put this together himself. And I'm like, I'm sure we're going to see those as services that people can go to, you know, and maybe even with a robot attached to that thing that you can actually talk out loud to something like that. And so we're getting into a really weird time of therapy.
Well, Zach, it's going to happen for sure, and which is why it's probably a good time for Jasmine, at least for now, to exit the profession, because there's not even going to be a human at the other end of that thing. You're going to be chatting it up with Tom Riddle's diary, not knowing where it keeps its brain. And it's going to be a complete dystopian land, because the thing is going to be asking you, like, what is your mental health today on a scale of 1 to 5, or, you know, going through its algorithm. But there's no actual human being there. At that point, I think we are fast approaching the digital singularity or whatever it's called, which takes us into some dystopian sci-fi scenarios there. Jasmine, you already mentioned like some limitations of a good psychology, and I wanted to see if you could flesh that out just a little bit. You mentioned that, you know, it's almost of an effect of the proverb that Jesus quoted, physician, heal thyself, kind of a reminder that any human physician is also subject to disease and illness. How much more so than for the therapist who, you know, is taking on the germs or taking on all these memories like Stephanie Winter does. She's exposed all these good memories and bad memories that are taking a toll on her, even though she's basically being hired to provide some sort of memory suppression for others. Like, how did that work in your case? And like, what are some of the risks there and some of the unavoidable limitations of that profession?
Yeah. I think definitely one of the things is the, in the attempts, I think, to decrease stigma, which is an admirable thing, I think what psychology has done is underemphasized our agency. It's really, when you look at our diagnostic manuals, it's really downplaying our ability to influence our situation. And it's very much, this is happening to you. This is something that you have to passively accept, take on. This is something that I guess you cannot control. And so the flip side of that message is, oh, I can't do anything about it. So you get people who are sort of walking around with, I've got depression, I've got OCD, you know, this is kind of my label, rather than, I guess, doing some of the hard work to, and I say this with full compassion of how difficult that is, because I struggled with those things myself. But, you know, there are steps that can be taken. You know, we accept what we can't change ultimately, and that's an important thing. You know, you change what you can, you accept what you can't. But I think that is very much one of the limitations of modern therapy, is that it is underemphasizing our ability to change. But also, I love what you said about physician heal thyself, because there are so many limitations in terms of what the therapist can do. You know, they're not someone who can read your mind, you know, as much as people like to think that psychologists can read our mind. They really can't. You know, there are many people, myself included, you know, who in a therapeutic situation might not be completely truthful and might not be, I mean, self-report, you know, it's quite biased ultimately. And so there's a element of having to take the person at their word. And so I think that does limit sometimes the change that can take place in a more lasting sense, because we are our own worst enemy in that sense. You know, the heart is desperately sick and deceitful. And so I think Western psychology, it's very, it can sort of edge quite close to navel gazing, you know, the sense of going inside yourself for your healing, going inside yourself for the answers. And I think something that I've learned personally and professionally is that actually taking your eyes off yourself, putting your attention on your creator and, you know, going to him, I think it doesn't mean that we can't access therapy. You know, I see a psychologist and I get so much benefit from that, and it's awesome being able to talk about those things. But, you know, ultimately our healing needs to come, you know, of that, you know, deceitful, desperately sick heart within us. And that's not something that a modern psychologist can do. So there's definite limitations there. And just even on a sort of slightly related point, as a therapist, and this really influences my writing of Stephanie, you know, there is a limitation to the amount of pain that you can take on. I mentioned before, I had a lot of trauma in terms of my own practicing, and I ended up with an autoimmune condition as a result. So we say in psychology, the body keeps the score. There is a limit, I think, often to the amount of pain that we can take on. And, you know, we want to take on so much pain that the person is experiencing, but there are real limitations there. Whereas we have, you know, Jesus who says, you know, I'll take on your burdens, and, you know, my yoke is, you know, light, and we have that comfort for our souls. So we can go to him for everything. And I think that's amazing. He's the 24/7 therapist who, you know, he might not sort of talk to us face to face. That would be great. But yeah, we have so much comfort to be had from Jesus. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I think in addition to the best case scenario of folks who are trained to do this and who mean very well, there's also some limitations when you get some false religious worldviews embedded in there. There's a lot of materialism in some of this, which understandable, especially when other people overemphasize the spiritual and all of those things. That can get pretty complicated. And then you have folks bringing their materialism in for some very false conclusions, just like there would be some false faith healers on the other side who would promise miracles that God has not promised. There are some things, unfortunately, that human beings are just kind of stuck with sometimes. And yet we also have, I guess another word there, Jasmine, would be resilience. So, like, there is human agency. There are some things that we can do, particularly when in some cases, we take the focus off of ourselves and set them not just on Christ, but set them to other people, like set them to the task that is ahead of us. Like, that's not a cure all either, any more than, you know, therapy or a specific kind of therapy is the cure all. Sometimes there is no cure all on this earth. There is no one method that can relieve or cure these ills. In fact, we then look instead to our great physician just ahead in chapter 3, but not without a quick detour past our third sponsor, Realm Makers. I know a lot of folks have found, like, it's not a therapy conference. Realm Makers is a writer's conference for Christian fantastical creators who show up once every year and then have an ongoing social network as well throughout the year. They get training in their craft, understanding the industry, understanding professional development from an all-star cast of creators that Realm Makers brings in. And this year's conference is actually held in St. Louis again, July 18th through 20th of 2024. Registration is open, and you'll want to sign up at realmmakers.com to get in on this. It's an amazing event. I've been to all but two of those, and a lot of folks enjoy finding that community that Jasmine mentioned earlier. Realm Makers has so much like-mindedness among people, even different genres. And Christians of different traditions and others, like, they connect in the creative pursuit, and often they even find some healing from feeling so alone in their weird interest in spaceships or dragons, as well as the gospel of Jesus Christ. Get more information at realmmakers.com, or you can also see all those links and some more info in our show notes for episode 205, or go to lorehaven.com/podcast. All right, chapter 3, this is who we are going to celebrate this Good Friday, the Friday after this episode releases, and then we celebrate him even more because he's not just dead, having taken on the sins and sufferings of the world, he is alive as we commemorate on Resurrection Sunday. Chapter 3, Jesus Christ, the great physician, will heal all hurts. And Jasmine and Zach, I think it does help to know before we start talking about the victory Jesus Christ has over this, it just does help to know that Jesus himself suffered as much as humans do. You know, he emptied himself of certain divine prerogatives. He came down to earth. It was a descent. He was fully God, fully man. And as a result, because he was embodied, not just putting on a skin suit to swim around undersea with us, no. He was truly a man, and by the way, he's still truly a man to this day, even though he's glorified. At the time, he would have experienced pain, scratches, wounds, injuries. Did Jesus break a bone? We don't know. The scripture doesn't say, but by the little account that we have, he would have had a normal human childhood, complete with, I would guess, stresses. Now, did that afflict him mentally? We're not told. If it did, it wouldn't have been through any sin that he would have done. I remember back, actually, The Chosen did an episode where they showed Jesus at the end of a long day of healing, and he is just totally exhausted. A lot of people got annoyed by that because they thought Jesus would be Superman or something. But even the good Superman movies don't show Superman like that. Otherwise, you lose complete touch with his character and his heroic nature. How much more so Jesus, who underwent the usual human struggles that we ourselves suffer, even in his life of righteousness, before he got to his death on a cross. Physical abuse, trauma, torture, all at once, one terrible period of days, the Passion Week leading up to that. And then on Good Friday, the sky goes dark, he's hung up there, he is tortured. Two thieves are insulting him before one of them apparently has a change of heart. The crowd's insulting him, everyone's turning against him, and all of his loved ones who managed to show up are looking upon him, and they can't do anything. There's no crowd of angels from heaven, and yet all Jesus had to do was flip a switch in his mind like a superpower, and they would have showed up. But he didn't. He went through that for his people. He went through that for anybody who would later repent and believe in him. And so what a terrific example, right? But it doesn't end there. Unless we get lost, though, in those past details, let us focus on the future hope. Jesus not only rose from the grave, conquering every single illness, disease, reversing those wounds, mental, physical, whatever. He then ascends to heaven, and then someday he will return. That's where I catch up here in Revelation 21. Jasmine, you mentioned that Jesus is like the ultimate therapist, not in a silly youth pastor way, but because he is, oh, the wonderful counselor. Now, there's probably a royal connotation there, but the English mind hears that and they think, oh, you know, like a counselor. Well, he's also that. But even better, he's the great physician who heals. In Revelation 21, 1 through 5, where the new heaven descends to new earth, it also says that Jesus will wipe away every tear. And that's what we would hope from a good counselor or a good psychologist or even a good pastor or priest. But those guys are stuck in the sin with us. Jesus is not. He's conquered it. He has defeated it decisively. And it's not that Jesus like erases the tear ducts. People are crying, tears of relief or old mourning or whatever, and Jesus resolves them. I'm thinking of the Tolkien term eucatastrophe, as I almost always am, the good cataclysm. So Jasmine, I'm curious, in your two jobs, both as a clinical psychologist and now also as a fantastical novelist, like how does that hope of the future resolution, the healing of all harms by Jesus, like how does that drive your storytelling and your reality?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, it's such a great comfort to me. In terms of my own reality, I live with chronic illness. I live with aspects of mental illness. My husband and I have had a really rocky journey these past few years with his cancer and acute illness and infertility and, you know, all the ups and downs of that. It is such a comfort to think that one day that there will be, you know, that Jesus will wipe away every tear from our eyes. That I read that passage to my grandmother just before she passed away. And it was such an amazing comfort. I think for that reason, all my books do end with that eucatastrophe. They all end happy. I know that there's a bit of an argument to be made for stories that reflect a bit of life, you know, where sometimes it doesn't end happily. Sometimes things are not all wrapped up. And it's not like in my stories things are all wrapped up in a pretty bow. But I do make a real concerted effort to depict that because, you know, the journey is quite dark. As you said, you know, sometimes there's aspects of that grim dark in my storytelling, but it all ends on that happy note. And sometimes I get questions from readers. I'll get sort of messages along the lines of like, oh my goodness, everything has fallen apart. How on earth are you going to fix this? How are you going to bring this all to a conclusion? I can't possibly see how this is going to end well because I do mess with things a bit. I do unravel things a bit. But my reassurance back to them is always, you know, I'm going to bring it all together. I'm going to bring it to that point. It's going to come together. It's going to happen, you know, going to be very, very satisfying. I always go for that emotionally satisfying ending. And it's interesting when I do that, when I offer those reassurances, I'm often reminded of, I guess the broader thing in terms of our brokenness in the world. We have this struggle with brokenness and pain, and so often our question to God is, you know, how are you going to fix this? How are you going to make this better? How is there ever going to be a world where things are, you know, so amazing that you can just wipe away the tears? And how can you make this very dark world? How can you redeem it? And so I guess that's where I think there's such a space for hope and for holding on to God's promises. And you see that in Clore and Lumen in the character of Stephanie. She's hopeful. That is, you know, I'm not going to give away where things go in the third book, but, you know, there's a trajectory there of her learning to hope in the midst of the darkness. And that applies to Soulmark and Carver of Souls as well. There's that, you know, things are really bleak and desolate right now, but there's gonna be a come. There's gonna be a turn. This is not the end. You know, there's something better around the corner. And so, I think, you know, personally, how I've sort of applied that life in the waiting room is that, you know, trying to cultivate that hope and holding on to God's promises. You know, as the Spurgeon quote goes, trusting God's heart when you can't see his hands. And I guess the prayer in the interim is asking, the way I heard it the other day from, I think it was a Tessa Afshar book, was, you know, our prayer is, Lord, give us what we would need if we knew everything that you know, which I really love. Like, that's sort of become a bit of my prayer of late as we're working through several things in our personal lives. Lord, you know, cultivate in us, you know, a spirit of your will be done. And that's just beautifully exemplified by Jesus on the cross, that he is surrendering to God's ultimate plan for his life. He knows that things are going to be better. He knows that he's going to be resurrected, but he also knows everything that he has to go through in the interim. And yeah, I love Easter. It's my favorite time of year. I think it's just amazing for that reason. It's just the darkness and the desolateness and the brokenness, but Sunday is coming, if that makes sense.
It's like we get glimmers of that now, right? Sometimes we are healed from things that plague us, whether it's a physical illness, a mental illness, or some other kind of bad situation. And we get to see glimpses of what he's going to do. And sometimes what we are healed with has drawbacks, right? Like we've all seen the commercials for every kind of prescription drug where they spend the second half of the commercial
side
talking about the side effects.
Include.
Right. And, yeah, exactly. And, I mean, my favorite one ever was one that was like, it was a sleep aid. It was a sleep aid for shift workers who, you know, have to work the graveyard shift. And so they have insomnia. And at the very end of this huge long list of side effects, it was, and side effects may also include insomnia. It's so like, why am I taking this then? So you know, true. It's like we have our best attempts at it. And this isn't to knock anyone in the medical industry or anything, but it's, I think it just makes us groan more, where it's like we get a little taste of what healing could look like. And then it doesn't quite work out to where we're like, now I want Jesus to come back even more. You know, it's this temporary healing I got is almost worse in a way, because it almost got me back to where I was. And now I realize how much further away that is, but it is still pretty cool though, how he has given us the capability to imperfectly heal things. You know, we're talking about the brain mostly in terms of the mind, but there's also the physical aspect of the brain. And yesterday, as we record this, I watched the live stream video from Neuralink, where they implanted a microchip into this young man's brain, who's quadriplegic. He had a diving accident where like his fourth or fifth vertebrae was severed. And so from basically his shoulders down, he's totally paralyzed and he's in this special wheelchair. And what they were able to do with this Neuralink implant was give him the ability to wirelessly control a mouse on a computer screen, basically the trackpad on a laptop. And so as they're talking about the surgery and the ability of Neuralink, he's sitting there playing a game of chess on his computer. And then he's also talking about how he played some other video game like Civilization or something, and he played it for like 8 hours straight. And he's like, normally, if I was to do something on the computer, I would have to use like a mouth wand. But now it's like I'm using the force.
I really hope that he is sitting in this yellow chair like Professor X with his two fingers touched to his forehead.
It's funny you should mention that. He said that's going to be his Halloween costume this year.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. I called it.
And you know, the guy was a really likable guy. He had to have been, I don't know, in his 20s. He volunteered for this trial just because he wanted to help other people, you know, have some hope who are also paralyzed. And there was something really beautiful about it. I mean, there's tons of jokes about becoming the Borg and all that. And, you know, certainly it makes me nervous thinking about what if a software update goes bad, because we've all had those on our devices that have made something really work poorly. But I'm also thinking, well, what are the possibilities? Like, what could this do besides move a mouse? Could he control an exoskeleton, you know, that he walks around in?
It's mech suit
cool.
time. It's mech suit time.
I mean, give me the mech suits. Let's have it right now, right? But, and you know, and that would be really cool, but it's again, like what Jesus will give us in the future in terms of healing is going to be so much better than that. You know, again, it's like the youth pastor, like, you've heard of the Neuralink, but have you heard of, you know, the coming whatever fix to your brain and body that's going to be?
Zach's not a youth pastor. If he could have just rolled that right off his tongue if he were.
Yeah. So I love this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm a tech geek, so I really geeked out over this thing. But at the same time, of course, there's going to be a downside. There might even be a dark side. I mean, that's what, frankly, I haven't heard any limiting principles that Neuralink is operating by. So, and Elon Musk has even said, well, this is to help us sort of merge with the power of, you know, personal AI so that we can resist the power of like corporate super AI or something.
It sounds like just something a mad scientist would say. Next, he's going to strap these, you know, prehensile robotic arms on the back of his back, and he's going to start working with the cold fusion reactor like Doc Ock.
And my kids are already talking about this at school. Like, they came home one day and said, oh, all the kids in second grade said that Elon Musk is going to shove a brain chip into them, and
they've already been implanted. Them. All the kids in second grade, the revolution is underway. Yeah. So that's a bad future, but we look forward to a good future, you know, where Jesus heals every harm and presumably removes all the newer links that turned us all into techno zombies and cleans up everything that went wrong from human beings who mean well, who come up with these technologies and treatments and mental health and all of these things that often work, sometimes don't, but are at best limited in their application. And until Jesus comes back and fixes everything, though, we do have some good treatments. But also, I think even more importantly for the sake of this discussion, we have great fiction. We have stories that help us simulate what it's going to be like to be healed, not just to go through all the terrible things, dystopians and storms and pirates and separation and all of this. But we look forward to the resolution at the end of the story. And so, Jasmine, as we draw to a close, your book most recently just came out. That is Carver of Souls, which completes the Soul Mark duology. Do you want to talk about that and then let us know what's next to close out the Nightingale trilogy?
Yeah. It's there's so much happening at the moment. I am really thankful for readers who are bearing with me through two series that have been incomplete until now, because I'm
you're not supposed to do that, but you're doing it.
Breaking all the rules. But yeah, Carver of Souls, it's my romantic pirate adventure fantasy. If you can think of Pirates of the Caribbean meets C.S. Lewis, like a sort of grown-up C.S. Lewis, grown-up Narnia, meets maybe like Laura France novels. It's very, very sort of eclectic and different. I think fantasy lovers might sort of notice that, the sort of light touches of fantasy in there. But very much dealing with sort of questions about mercy and justice. And it's set in a world that essentially is like a dramatization of sin eaters. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the practice, the idea that one person pawns their soul for the collective. And all the different drama that happens there. So that's finished now, that series. And it is a roller coaster conclusion. But like I said before, it will always end happily. There's always going to be that catastrophe, at the end. In the meantime, December is Memoria, the finale to the Nightingale trilogy. So the conclusion to the adventure, and then there's lots more to come after that. So how long you got?
That is wonderful. Well, where can folks track your progress? Websites, social platforms, like give us the whole pitch for a step back through the painting.
So jjfisher.com is my website. So please feel free to sign up to my newsletter. Otherwise follow me on Instagram and Facebook are predominantly my main platforms. I'd love to hear from readers. You know, if you want to send me an email, I love getting emails from readers. But they're probably the best ways to contact me. Snail mail to Australia is very slow, so probably nothing there. And as I say, carrier pigeon, very much on the down. These days.
Yeah, see the show notes for all of those links to keep track of Jasmine J.J. Fisher's work. Jasmine, thank you so much for stopping by. Thank you for your openness, your professionalism, and also just your creative heart, not just for wonderful fictional worlds, but for the real world that is destined for real healing in the future. So Godspeed to you and your husband and all of yours.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, that was a great conversation with J.J. Fisher, our first Aussie on the podcast. And Stephen, I made it that whole way without making a kangaroo joke or Crocodile Dundee impression. So I'm quite proud of myself. Now, of course, Jasmine, you're free to make fun of the Alamo or armadillos or whatever you have in your bag of jokes about Texas culture. That's totally fine. But we're going to move into our comm station now. We got a great note on Twitter from a listener named Jennifer Ray. She found episode 202, which was 4 years later, How Did Pandemic Lockdowns Change Our Reading Experience? And Jennifer said, quote, I tried out this podcast today on my commute to work. This was the episode that I chose, and I enjoyed listening to the banter between the co-hosts. I'm not even into fiction books, but the content here was super relatable in other aspects. Too bad I had to pause it to go to work, end quote.
Yeah, fortunately, we are unpausable once the work is over. A little bit of recreation there in between your daily callings there. Thanks for listening, Jennifer. Yeah, most folks, I think they're not into fiction, but I'm guessing you've got some fiction sprinkled throughout your everyday. So who knows? Maybe us crossing over into a more non-fiction-y topic there would help you get the inkling to check out some of the great Christian fantastical novels that we found at Lorehaven.
Now, we appreciate you listening, and to you, our listener, we would like to know, how do you anticipate Jesus saving you from suffering? You know, Stephen, I appreciate in this episode how you talked about The Earth Strikes Back, which sounds like the best B-movie title ever.
I can see the poster. That's very true. There's a creature at this end of the earth, and it's striking back, and it's groaning.
I mean, because we had glimmers of this in the M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening, with the awful acting from Mark Wahlberg. And we kind of got it in 2012, the movie, but there was so much cheesiness in that. I want to see a movie called The Earth Strikes Back. I just think it'd be fantastic. So that is going on right now, as I said, in Central Texas. It's going on. We've got the eclipse coming up, and people are saying all kinds of apocalyptic things about that. But there will come a time when all of that stops and all of our diseases stop, all crime stops, and just personal temptation stops. So to you, our listener, which of those things are you looking forward to the most? So send us a note to podcast@lorehaven.com. Of course, you can tag us on Twitter like Jennifer did, or find us on Facegram or Instabook.
Keep it in.
Find one of those.
X-Face Instagram book. Yes. Next on Fantastical Truth. Ready to spring into reading. Well, unless you live in Australia, we are past now the spring equinox of this year. And so we here at Lorehaven are planning blockbuster guests and topics for this season and the summer and beyond. For example, the theme for next week's episode is probably a little something like this. What happens when your pastor or a pastor you've heard about or some popular religious leader within Christianity, so he's a brother, starts criticizing, warning against popular culture and fantastical stories? They're only bad. They're only temptations. You must discern, and maybe throw them out and burn them in an oil drum in the backyard. What is a faithful Christian fan to do? How do you not be a jerk to that person while also be convinced in your own heart what is right? Let's explore that very soon on Fantastical Truth. Meanwhile, it's great to have Jasmine in here. Two different skill sets there, and I think skill sets that ought not be divided. Human beings are whole creatures. We do not bifurcate. We don't split our imaginations to one side and our mental health to the other side. What affects one will affect the other. So let's remember that God has made us to be whole creatures, body and soul. And that death and suffering will split body and soul apart. That's called death. It's terrible. But this Resurrection Sunday, we celebrate the one who brought himself back together, back from the grave. And just as he resurrected himself, he will raise all who believe in him to eternal life and healing. rejoice in that as we continue to seek and find his fantastical truth.